books and more than 200 articles. He's a fellow of the Royal Society for the Arts and has a number of other accomplishments to his name, which I will not mention at the moment. It's my great pleasure to call upon him to make a presentation for about 20 minutes, after which we will have input by the bio that I'll introduce him later on.
You let me know if I get close to the time.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank UNESCO, first of all, for inviting me to speak here today. This is quite an honor, and in a way I hope the sorts of issues that I raise in my paper, which I'll only be able to summarize in my talk, will resonate with you and perhaps give you some ideas that you can take back. Because in a sense, I think that the future of knowledge production in general lies in the hands of people like you in the audience. My own background is as an academic. I've never held a policy position. And in fact, as was mentioned in the introduction, I come from a sort of interdisciplinary background. And in a sense, my own research program has been designed to sort of bridge the gaps between disciplines. And in particular, one that I think is quite strongly felt within academia, and that is, on the one hand, between sort of normative perspectives about where knowledge should go, what's the point of knowledge, those kinds of questions, which traditionally have been handled by philosophy, and then issues, empirical issues, about how knowledge actually has been produced in many different settings and so forth, where the historical and social scientific disciplines have been involved. Now, obviously, policymakers will find both of these disciplines very important for their work. Unfortunately, within academia, they do not come together naturally. And in fact, not only do they not come together naturally, the sorts of things that we actually need to study, let's say, empirically, in order to get a comprehensive understanding about the nature of knowledge, is fragmented among several disciplines. And not only several disciplines, but several sub-disciplines. So, for example, the sociology of higher education, for the most part, is concerned about the study of teaching and training, whereas the sociology of science is primarily concerned about research. And you would think that if you're going to have some kind of integrated view about knowledge production, you need these two things to work together. Now, it seems to me that all of this sort of difficulty, this sort of problem, which my project of social epistemology is dedicated to, is emblematic of a problem that faces us today in the world, and that is the disappearance, you might say, of the university as a unified concept. Okay, because the university classically has been the place where teaching and research has been integrated. In fact, that's been sort of the defining institutional mission of the university, not only in its sort of renovated form in the 19th century with von Humboldt, but also in the Middle Ages as well. And it seems that we have now increasingly come to think about these two activities as separate from each other and measurable by different criteria and so forth. And it seems to me this is the death knell of the universe, of an integrated sense of knowledge production, the disappearance of the university. So that one of the things that I've come to conclude over the years is that, in fact, we need to preserve the university. We need, in a sense, to reinvent the university as an integral institution that isn't just reducible either to a bunch of science parks or a bunch of diploma mills. Okay, and so this is the context from which I am coming here. Now, in the printed version of the paper that you can pick up here at the conference, it turns out that that a sort of list of my publications and my background were omitted, and I think it was because the paper was reformatted. But if you go to the website where my paper is, in case you want to follow up some of the issues that I raise, they're there. Okay, and as you can see, there's my website. I mean, my email address. And if you Google me, you'll see a website there, and the website includes things like not only articles but also audio lectures, which I've recently added on in case you want to sort of hear what some of this stuff sounds like again, if it doesn't make sense to you the first time around. And also, I will be here for a couple of hours after my talk, and so if people want to talk to me, please feel free to do so. So I've sort of planned this. I'm not leaving immediately. Okay, with all that in the background. Now, as an academic, the way I got sort of, you might say, sucked into this topic was through, I've written several books on social epistemology, but I also wrote a book on the governance of science in 2000. And then after that, I started getting contacted by people involved in knowledge management, which is sort of, you might say, the vanguard discipline for the sort of, what I call the knowledge society newspeak. And if you look at the paper, you'll see I have a kind of translation manual between the way in which people talk about things in the knowledge society and what they really mean. And the things that on the surface may seem very progressive and emancipatory about knowledge, in fact, is just sort of a sort of dressed up version of high capitalism. I mean, to put it in a nutshell, I mean, the paper goes into more details about this, but we have to speak briefly and bluntly here about this. And the thing that what caused me to think about this in this way was when I started exploring some of the knowledge management literature. As you know, this thing is omnipresent in airport bookshops around the world. And in fact, that's probably where the primary clientele base is. One of the things that I found in one of these books was that the difference between a smart and dumb organization. Okay? A smart organization is a whole, that is greater than the sum of the parts. So smart organization is something like McDonald's, where you have basically a lot of low-skilled, maybe even functionally illiterate people, who because of some kind of managerial genius, the way they can be arranged in a shop, can produce billions of hamburgers. Right? So, as it were, low human capital, high structural capital, as they say in the business. And this then is a smart organization, and this is the kind of thing that knowledge management aims to maximize. What's a dumb organization? A university. A university, because a university is the exact opposite. A university is a whole that is less than the sum of the parts, because it is very high on human capital. You've got a lot of PhDs running around, but what do they add up to? Which dean or senior administrator knows where the various professors are at any given moment? So, from the standpoint of knowledge management, they're going to have a field day. This is a window of opportunity to do something. Okay? And this was really quite a revelation for me. Because it seems that, you know, in all of this talk about everything being knowledge-based and knowledge society, that in fact what's happened is that there is a sort of deterioration, you might say deflation, of the term knowledge that's taking place. Okay? And sometimes people like to put a sort of happy face on this by saying we're deprivileging the university. Well, in fact, we've always known that knowledge came from many different places. This is not just something that started to happen with the end of the Cold War or the end of World War II or even the end of the First World War. Okay? Knowledge has always been coming from different places. But the university has had a very distinctive role as being a kind of clearinghouse where all of these knowledges from many different locations, and I'm not just talking about indigenous knowledges, but also the high science end of things, also has primarily come from outside the university. But it's through the university, and in fact through the manufacture of the curriculum, that you actually get some kind of integrated understanding of knowledge that can then be reproduced and transmitted to a much larger range of people than from where the knowledge originally came. Okay? And it seems to me this is a very crucial function of universities, and it is in fact what makes universities the sole manufacturer of knowledge as a public good. And that is a very important point to take away here, because we need to recall what a public good is. And throughout the conference, there have been people who have sort of been grumbling about economics in various ways, or economism, right, which is when you grumble about economics but don't want to commit yourself to anything you actually want to criticize, okay? But in fact, economics may be the source of our problems, but it is also partly the source of the solution, because public good is an economic concept that is very valuable to rehabilitate. And the key thing to say about the concept of public good, it is that it is a product of the welfare state. It is a concept that really does not exist before, in fact, the 1950s. Paul Samuelson is usually the person who is regarded as the main person behind this. And the idea of public good has to do with a kind of calculation that, let's say, the welfare maximizer makes, the state, right, by saying that it would actually cost more to restrict access to the good than to allow it to flow freely. That is to say, to allow free riders, people who don't pay their own way. Now, this kind of understanding of public good is, in fact, very integral to what the welfare state has been about. Okay? And in fact, not only the welfare state, but also why people have been willing to pay their own taxes for universities, even in periods when relatively few people ever went to universities. Okay? Because, you know, you think about it, if we go before the period of 1960, we have a very small percentage of people going to universities, but everybody's paying for them to be maintained. Why? Well, you sort of might say, okay, only the rich are going to benefit from it, because they're the ones who are better educated to begin with. But what you imagine, right, is that, in fact, what they may come up with may benefit everyone as a whole. And if you don't let them do this, right, then you're not actually going to be able to capture those benefits. And so it seems to me what's very important about the concept of public good is the idea that you're actually thinking of society as a whole, and you're thinking about the value of a good for society as a whole, even including those who are not directly involved in the production, or who may not even be directly involved in the consumption. But nevertheless, you have this sort of larger notion, because you don't know who exactly is going to benefit, and you don't want to restrict the access for that reason. And universities have been very integral to that kind of notion of public good. Now, public good is not the same as not private. Right? That's in a sense a very important point, because in these neoliberal times, and this is the neo part of the neoliberal, right, the idea is, well, what we can do is we want to make knowledge flow as freely as possible, and so we don't want monopolies on knowledge anymore. And from that standpoint, universities often look like monopolies of knowledge. So we want universities to become more competitive with other institutions outside itself, right, for purposes of producing knowledge, to show that they can really provide stuff for the consumer. Okay, well, you might say that, but it doesn't follow from that sort of perspective that you're then going to get knowledge that is going to be of benefit to everyone. Because who is in a position to take most advantage of a monopoly when it's been freed up, when things have been deregulated? Deregulation doesn't mean democracy. Because there are going to be certain positions, certain kinds of private firms, let's say science parks or diploma mills, that are going to be able to take better advantage of a situation where universities don't have a monopoly than others. And so you're just going to get a reproduction of asymmetries, maybe with the players slightly shifted, slightly different, but it's not going to democratize in any kind of full-blown sense, and it's not going to realize knowledge as a public good. Okay, and it seems to me that this kind of way of thinking about focusing on that kind of issue about knowledge as a public good and the university as the primary provider of that, you really do need a certain kind of economics to kind of really see this through, a kind of welfare economics, okay, that will in fact use a lot of the same equations as the bad economics, but it will be put to a different purpose. Okay? And so I think there's a sense in which one has to kind of remind ourselves of this point, because this relates to a lot of other issues here. If we're talking about social progress, if we're talking about the university as a vehicle of social progress, we have to always keep in mind that these things do need to be measurable. You have to be able to say you're doing something better than you did before. So people who want to sort of get rid of the concept of measuring and counting and quantification as if that's the source of our problems, you're never going to be able to tell whether you're getting anywhere closer or farther away from a goal. And so again, one has to sort of step back and think, what is progressive here? And, you know, what I recommend to you in this context is a little study of the history of science. Okay? Because the history of science is not so black and white that one can say, for example, economics is bad, quantification is bad, okay? Those things should not be demonized. Because in fact, what I think can say about the history of science is that any form of thought or any method that has in fact done a lot of bad has probably also done a lot of good because it's been powerful. And this is where policymakers come in, right? Policymakers have to make the judgment calls on this. Okay? So one just can't say, oh, if we got rid of this mode of thought, that would be the end of the story. Okay. How much more time do I have? 5 minutes. Okay. Right, so the idea about what the university is, you know, if you need a slogan to take away from it, is the idea that because the universities are uniquely in this business of manufacturing public goods, right, they are in the business of creatively destroying social capital. And so maybe I should, there are a lot of other things I bring up in the paper, and I'm quite happy if the commentator wants to bring this up as well, because, you know, we can discuss this. But I think that this is a kind of important point about what that means, the creative destruction of social capital. Because I think nowadays, the idea of the university as being a place for the unity of teaching and research has become seen as a kind of old humanistic thing, you know, that you pat people on the head, you know, oh, that's nice, but nothing really is like that. Okay? And so in a sense, it is true that this ideal of the unity of teaching and of research, a unity of teaching and research, is a product of a humanistic-based university, that's true, and it is in fact, you know, which is to say it doesn't have a lot of the economic and material problems that universities face now. Nevertheless, it seems to me you can reinvent this in a more high-tech, scientized kind of age. And this is what I talk about in the paper. It's one of the things I talk about in the paper. And the way to do it is to think about that any mode of research, if we're talking especially about scientific research, which is very capital intensive and typically involves lots of expertise up front. So in other words, relatively few people could actually be involved in its production because of the sort of elite nature of the thing, right? But in a sense, what that does is it manufactures a certain kind of social capital because it enables the people who are involved in the research and those who are paying for it especially to be able to gain some kind of advantage over the rest of the population. So the question becomes, what have we got here when we've got this new innovative research? Do we just have another way of re-stratifying society? Well, yes, we will if we go down the route of intellectual property and we separate research out from teaching. Because the whole point of the university is that this new research that's being produced feeds back into the curriculum. And it's when it feeds back into the curriculum, it becomes part of the public domain, as it were. It becomes something that is made part of what students, no matter their background, even if they weren't involved in the production, even if they're not part of the client base, that they can then learn themselves and do something with, that is the destruction. Right? So we've got so we have this creative destruction taking place where you remove the potentially elitist, right, and even maybe, you know, authoritarian tendencies of new knowledge to dominate over the rest by distributing it as widely as possible through the curriculum. And so from that standpoint, the curriculum committee, the people who design curricula, are in a sense the heart and soul of the university, much more so than the people who are on the cutting edge of research or anything of that kind. Because they are the people who have to think about what is it of all this new stuff that's coming on board now that needs to be reproduced for the general mass of the population, you know, larger percentages of whom are going to universities, in order to take the society forward in the future. You see, and it's by doing that, right, that then one has a form of knowledge that is in fact dynamic and is able to lead the society as a whole into a more progressive future. But it requires that twofold step. It is not enough just to support research. It actually has to be fed back into the curriculum so that more than just the people trained in the area get the benefits from it. And I mean it more than just at the level of consumption. I mean it at the level that people can use it for their own purposes. And that's why the curriculum is more important to me than, let's say, whether goods are manufactured that get patents and make money and stuff like that. Okay? So this is the point. This is the core point about what the point of the university is. And no other institution, either historically or likely in the future, is going to be performing this kind of role. And it seems to me this role is going to be increasingly integral to any kind of view that we may still have of an idea of social progress. And I guess I'll end here because I think that's sort of a convenient point to stay within the time limit. But I realize I haven't covered everything in the paper, but hopefully there'll be enough to think about here. Thank you very much.
Of Education and Physical Science at the University of one of our speakers on the first day of the
That should not surprise those who are familiar with his writing, and it should surprise those who aren't to take a look at one of his many books, among which I have found the Governance of Science book particularly useful. The paper that he presented, and that we forced him to summarize in a very brief span of time, which is but the paper that you presented and that is available to you stands out for several reasons. First, it covers an enormous amount of territory, ranging from the implications of the demise of the modern welfare state to the often arcane subtleties of university administration, and from the Roman corporate law of the Middle Ages your novelas and mode one and mode two knowledge. Secondly, he also is one of the few papers at this conference that have truly managed to span the full scope of this conference's theme, in that it ranges from some of the most complex issues of epistemology through the analysis of contemporary research, all the way to the very concrete issues of university governance, management, and funding. In the process, he does a very provocative job, I think, of forcing us to rethink the relationship between journal and research through the notion of the creative destruction of social capital. In my view, an extraordinarily suggestive, an extraordinarily stimulating way of rethinking that relationship between research and teaching. This is incidentally not meant to put down the many other fine papers that we have had at this conference, many of which focus and quite advisedly on a particular segment of this overall span. Does acknowledge with a great deal of admiration, and I should add envy, Steve Fuller's remarkable skill in drawing the big picture without losing touch with the realities of knowledge, research, and higher education. Thirdly, what I also like about the paper is its thorough and resolutely critical treatment of the knowledge society discourse. This has been a theme in a number of presentations and discussions at this meeting, but I dare say that we have in Fuller's paper a particularly incisive analysis of both the origins and the pernicious consequences of this discourse. Lastly, I believe we owe Steve particular thanks for his imaginative and very revealing analysis of what I would call the verbal superstructure of the politics of knowledge. His analysis of the new speak of the mode one and mode two protagonists and of the knowledge management theorists is not only delightfully sublime, but right on the money and the pun. Having said this, I now have to show that any discussion worth his veneer can find fault with the best of him. There is, I should observe, the occasional lapse into naivete, as when citizens, juries, quote, and other forms of deliberative democracy are expected to prevent disciplined boundaries from solidifying into natural phenomena, as if disciplines had not over a long time built up precisely the kinds of power structures designed to prevent this kind of accountability. Also, here as elsewhere, one would be curious to know whether and where some of Fuller's experiments have already been tried, and with what results. Like any good critical writer, Fuller is not entirely immune to the temptation of conspiracy theories, as when he suspects that Harvard University, as I quote, has the backing of the U.S. government, and hence suddenly trades of the superpowers monopoly of force, end quote. Someone comes from Stanford, I do not feel any particular charity towards Harvard, but that strikes me as kind of a banana. I could not help being particularly intrigued by Fuller's remarks on academic Caesarism, having tried my hand at a little bit of Caesarism myself as rector of a new university in what used to be Germany in the 1990s. I don't want to dwell on that experience, but it has taught me a thing or two about the limitations to which academic Caesars are subjected. It has also taught me that the relationship between institutional autonomy and the individual autonomy of the professor is probably a bit more complicated than Steve Fuller suggests. Fuller cites, apparently in agreement, Derek Buck, who advocates, and I quote, treating the university's corporate autonomy as an amplified version of each tenured academic's autonomy, unquote. This is, of course, what academic Caesars would like, but in reality, the corporate autonomy of the university is more often than not on a collision course with the autonomy of the individual faculty member. Put differently, the more autonomous a university seeks to become, more it has to encroach on its faculty members' individual autonomy in order to substantiate its autonomous corporate role and mission. On the same issue, Steve Fuller is, of course, not the first to reflect on the role of leadership in higher education, and one would have wished, without subscribing to any footnote fetishism, one would have wished a more explicit debate with this literature in Fuller's paper. Let me give you just one taste of how one finds in that literature both support for and dissent from Fuller's argument about academic Caesarism. My example is taken from one of the classics in the genre, Cohen and Marge's study of leadership and ambiguity, the American College president. And let me quote from that to illustrate what I mean. The college president has more potential for moving the college than most people, probably more potential than any other person. Nevertheless, presidents discover that they have less power than he believed, that their power to accomplish things depends heavily on what they want to accomplish, that the use of formal authority is limited by other formal authority, that the acceptance of authority is not automatic, that the necessary details of organizational life confuse power, which is somewhat different from diffusing it, and that their colleagues seem to delight in complaining simultaneously about presidential weakness and presidential willfulness, end of quote. To me, this does not sound exactly like Caesar and more like Jacques Chirac. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm a bit skeptical to imagine that they could be technological individualism which has prevailed in science production. I would submit to you that there is a parallel between technological individualism and possessive individualism in capitalist society, which then is mutually displayed in the practice of academia. And in short, if the argument is there is technological individualism, if there is possessive individualism, if the curriculum is more, then the whole of the short curriculum in academia is much more complex than it seems to come to your comments, which I know you have to catch up. Now, let's look at the other side of the issue, the curriculum outside academia. As a professor of education, you're supposed to do something instead of implementing curriculum in elementary and secondary education. But if I look at the U.S., I would submit to you that the curriculum is a much more complex process than just the knowledge produced in universities and then transfer someone into the realm of society. Curriculum is, in a way, a complex interaction of legislature trying to pursue particular interests, social movement pursuing particular interests, professional information saying the non-professional content, etc. What many people have defined in the laboratory is that official knowledge of the curriculum is not actually created by either the teachers of the knowledge society or the university professors who have some participation role, but it's created through a very complex relation between the different social movement and what we define as the conservative presentation of the U.S. And finally, I think the last aspect of this aspect of curriculum that plays a major role is the role of the publishing houses, which define the official knowledge and then also the curriculum. So the question is very simple. What curriculum are we talking about? How curriculum could be discussed in the context of your analysis? And when you refer to the function of the curriculum, how would you relate the problem of academic individualism in the university and the problem of the official knowledge outside the university? Some way of watching to make sense of your own answer.
Thank you. We'll take one more question here, then we'll get to the next one.
Thanks very much for those very stimulating comments. Should I speak for about 5 minutes? How long should I speak? Okay, I won't be able to address everything as comprehensively as they deserve to be, but let me try to pick up the points. The first comment about the public good versus public domain notion. The point that I wanted to stress in the paper and in the talk is that the concept of public good is not a sort of free-floating concept. It's a concept that presupposes a certain institutional structure. At the very least, it presupposes a perspective from which one can talk about issues of free riders, for example, in economics. In other words, who's getting the benefits without having to pay the costs and so forth. So it presupposes a sort of larger sort of social perspective within which one is talking then about utility maximization. And in that respect, even though it sort of starts with very classical economic assumptions, the framework within which it's posed is much more collectivist in the orientation. And that, I think, is a very important point to keep in mind about public good. Now, as far as universities not having a natural monopoly on knowledge, That's certainly true. I do think, however, that integration is very valuable. And again, going back to the history of universities is an important point here. Because the reason why integration was so valuable in the first place, you might say, especially if we look at the rise of the modern university in Germany, was because, in a sense, what you're doing is manufacturing citizens. Right? And so the idea of citizens in a progressive nation state that is trying to assert itself on the world, the idea is that you want, as it were, to make maximally available all the knowledge that is going to be of potentially most relevance to the next generation who are going to go forward. And it seems to me that there is no other institution that has been specifically dedicated to that task, and there remains no other institution specifically dedicated to that task, even though, for sure, there are some research parks that can probably out-research universities in certain cases, and there are certain diploma mills that can probably credential people in particular jobs better than some universities. But that is not the point of the integration of teaching and research. It is at the level of citizenship education. And this is why I think it's very important that you might say it's not by accident that the decline of the university, or the sort of, you might say, the disappearance of the vividness of the university as a guiding concept has come at a time when something similar has been happening to the state. Okay? These two things are actually quite intimately connected in the modern era. And that's why in the end of the paper, you know, the stuff about the Caesarism and the imperialism is actually about what I believe to be the university absorbing functions that previously were performed by state. I mean, that's kind of what that's the theme of that general part of the paper is, if you want to have a look at that. And that there's a sense in which, you know, if one talks about the decline of the state, where are those functions being picked up? Very often it is by universities. So this integrative function is not something that's actually being served by the market as it's normally understood, unless universities do it. Now, you might say citizenship itself is a myth, that we don't need to have this kind of common education or anything like that. That's another argument. But I presuppose that there is such a thing to be had. Now, insofar, the gentleman from Sudan and some of the other comments have talked about the disintegration of the teaching and research function of the university. Yes, that certainly has happened. One of the things that I think is very important here, and I allude to this at the end of the paper, is we really do not have a very good way of either studying or measuring the two things together. Okay? So there's a sense in which we're our own worst enemies, you might say. Because all of the metrics and all of the kinds of methods that are used to study what happens in universities tend to be very seriously bifurcated between looking at how teaching and training works and the jobs and things people go into versus looking at research and what kind of impact it has on the overall economy of the country or the development of knowledge itself. But the idea of having some kind of way of studying them in an integrated fashion, including integrated measures, it seems to me this is the kind of thing that ought to be on the front burner of what one needs to think about if one is going to provide some kind of vivid and measurable infrastructure for what a university is about. Okay? Because I do not believe that teaching and research can be talked about in these independent fashions if we're going to talk about the university as an institution. So there's a sense in which there is a kind of challenge to people who are involved in this business about keeping the university alive as a concept. Now, with regard to the arguments about the curriculum, this issue about the curriculum, I don't want to disagree with what Professor Torres is saying as a kind of empirical account of what goes on, and especially in the United States, where in a sense every professor is sort of his own curriculum kind of thing, the Mandarinization business, right? And I do think here this is where the issue of academic leadership plays a very important role. So if we're talking about, you know, training the next generation of academic Caesars, whether we're talking about university presidents or provosts or whoever might be in charge of curriculum matters, it seems to me that the curriculum has to be seen as something of vital importance to more than just members of particular departments, than more than just a particular client based outside the university, in the sense of industry or something like that, but has to be seen as a kind of defining function of the university that senior administration will take and sort of take an active interest in trying to cultivate, and actually, you might say, knock heads. Right? In other words, get people who don't, in a sense, want to contribute and be part of this common process of contributing to a common body of knowledge that's distributed to large numbers of students. This, in fact, ought to be one of the mandates of academic leadership with regard to professors. And that, in a sense, part of the obligation of academic freedom for a professor ought to be the obligation to publicly speak the knowledge, and that should involve the curriculum. that if you're in fact doing something that is some significance to more than just a few specialists in your field, it should be possible to integrate it into the curriculum somehow. You should have some kind of input into that matter. And it shouldn't be something that one, as it were, tries to or be satisfied with escaping from. Okay, because again, I think that, and so there is an issue, there's a kind of vacuum of academic leadership here, which of course leads to all of these kinds of problems about the curriculum. And then I'll say just one more point about that. I think the key thing about universities that I think needs to be stressed about the point about it being the creative destroyers of social capital is that the universities have been very much in the forefront of taking up people who have been traditionally disenfranchised from the universities and bringing them in as recruits, you might say. And I talk a bit about that in the paper with regard to affirmative action. And it seems to me that is a very important function within which this issue of curriculum redesign has to always be understood. So the fact is, you probably know, in the United States there are enormous, what was called in the first talk, culture wars, but you know, canon wars, literally, right? In other words, what books get put on the curriculum, right? I know a lot of people find this very destructive. I think it's actually, you know, if one puts this in perspective, it's actually quite a healthy process in a way, because it makes everybody very concerned that this university is a very important place where the next generation of people are being produced, and it becomes very important to figure out what they learn. And so people on the left and people on the right will have all kinds of disputes, and they have to have these disputes because the curriculum, by definition, is a scarce resource. You can only put so many things on it. And so, which goes in and which goes out? And this forces you to think about what kind of a society do you want the next generation to live in? And I think that is a perfectly valuable, perfectly reasonable kind of discussion. It is very heated. People lose their temper. But it is the sort of thing that, in a sense, ought to be institutionalized on a regular basis. And in that respect, you know, I think that aspect of the American context is worth learning from. And I guess I'll stop here so we can pick up more questions. see you. See, the more time you have to think about this, the tougher questions you ask. So luckily, we're going to be ending soon. Okay, let's start from the top. The problem of the underfunding of universities. Part of the problem that the problem I sort of addressed most fully in the paper, and I think I've been saying here, has to do with the way universities are represented. That the distinctiveness and the value of universities really isn't. It's really not sold properly in any kind of distinctive way, because the reason being that the university isn't sold as a special institution, and in a sense the uniqueness and the fact that there wouldn't be competitors to do the actual combination of things that universities do. But of course that requires not just a verbal argument, but it requires ways of measuring it and studying it and so forth. And so again, this is, as it were, launching a research program, but I do think there is a real rhetorical problem about presenting universities as unique. But I also think there's a kind of material problem, and this has to do with the fact that as a larger percentage of people go to universities, they become more expensive to subsidize if they're being subsidized by the state. And so, and as the states already have a kind of fiscal burden to begin with, it's quite easy to sort of offload the university and say, well, look, you know, universities are glorified service providers. We'll open it to the market and let people pay their way and all the rest of it. And that's a very easy kind of option to take on the part of the state as universities get larger and larger. And it's happening all over Europe, certainly, and other places in the world. And it seems to me that, in a sense, that's something that I think the people who put forward the original ideals about the unity of teaching and research didn't quite anticipate. And that in fact, you know, with the massification of the university, there'd be this normal fiscal burden that will then cause people to rethink what universities are for. But here I think, I mean, there are a lot of answers to this question. There is something to the point that was made by the gentleman from Geneva about discriminating between different institutions of higher education and what they're for exactly. I think there's something to that. But also I do think, we really haven't talked about this aspect of the paper here, but if you go back to the Middle Ages and you go back to the original idea of what corporate autonomy meant for the university, one of the things that it meant was the ability to be self-funding, to raise its own funds, and to raise its own funds in the manner of a religious order. Not in the manner of tuition, but in the manner of those who have already experienced the education and realized the overall, whatever you want to call it, intellectual, spiritual value of the thing, not necessarily related to the line of work they're in, want to put something back in so that more people can have the same experience. So it's not by accident, for example, that all these American universities with these enormous endowments, right, you know, it's anchored in the fact that you had a lot of Protestant dissenters from Britain who founded these places, who actually thought about universities very much along those lines. Right? There's a sense in which the graduates subsidized to a considerable extent, and this continues to happen today at elite universities in America. I'm a beneficiary of it, in fact. I come from a poor background. I went to Columbia University. 70% of students are subsidized. So you see a tuition fee of whatever, $25,000. How many people are paying that? This is being, and it seems to me this is one way. This is one way, in fact, in which you can think about alternative funding. But that means you have to think about the university as something of a kind of like a spiritual institution that sort of where you revalorize this business of knowledge for its own sake, that has some overarching value for people's lives beyond just the jobs they get to function in their particular environment. Because that's what motivated the idea of people giving to universities in the first place. And I do think we're going to have to move toward that, because I would hate to see a situation where everybody's just paying their way. Because at that point, the university loses its integrity. I think that's really clear. We should try to avoid this, you know, pay-your-way approach that's becoming so popular in Europe. But I can't believe that unless we raise taxes massively, we're going to be able to subsidize through public funding universities, given the large numbers of people who are going to them now. I mean, it seems to me that you can't, that there isn't a political climate for that kind of thing. Okay? So this is another reason why we have to reassert, you know, this distinctiveness of the university, because we're going to have to try to think about funding it in a somewhat different way. I know I'm running out of time here, I realize. I'm trying to think about what can I address in short term. The Sarajevo thing, it seems to me that, you know, part of the business of what I called academic imperialism, and this is where I talk a lot about Harvard, I have a sort of grudging respect for Harvard University, because Harvard University acts as if it's one of the major first world powers, right? And it seems to me that a place as rich as Harvard University could, it seems to me, subsidize its own faculty or perhaps even its sort of graduate students and so forth to actually occupy some of these positions in the Sarajevo University that you're talking about. As part, I don't want to call it like a work-study scheme or something, that just trivialized the situation, but in a sense to actually sort of subsidize people to go out there, to spend some time there, to develop the intellectual infrastructure of the place before turning it over to the people who are on the ground. It seems to be a place as well endowed as Harvard, which already has a very strong tradition of being involved in international development, could go into this kind of situation quite comfortably, and it would be very much part of its corporate image. Okay? And so in a sense, this is a kind of, as it were, a sort of charge for the very wealthy private universities of the world, who in a sense have been historically in this kind of business. So I don't think it's completely out of the question from the standpoint of what universities have done in the past to be able to go into a situation like that. Okay? I guess, you know, just off the top of my head, it seems to me that there are some well-endowed private universities who could probably do something like that. I don't think this could happen with a kind of state-run university in Europe. I think that the cost constraints and things would be too severe. But I could see a private American university doing this. I guess maybe I should just stop. I realize I haven't addressed everyone's things, but...
I guess
Thank you.